To what extent is individual personality a factor in entrepreneurial success? What about picking the right market and choosing the most productive customers and building the strongest possible relationships with them? We explore both courage and relationship building in this week's episode.
This is the Economics for Entrepreneurs podcast, a project of the Mises Institute, applying the principles of economics to start, grow, and manage your business. For free tools, resources, key takeaways, and actionable insights from each episode, visit Mises.org/E4EPod. Now, here's Hunter Hastings.
Hi, Hunter Hastings here. At Economics for Entrepreneurs, our goal is always to help entrepreneurs succeed through an understanding of the applicable laws of economics and the mind of the customer. There's another way we can help, I think, and that's by meeting successful entrepreneurs, those who triumphed in practice by identifying markets and serving them with excellence. To what extent did the laws of economics help them? How special is their understanding of the mind of the customer? What other factors came into play? What was the role of personality and personal attributes? What about mentors and colleagues? What about luck? When we meet these entrepreneurs, let's listen not with a view to emulating and imitating necessarily, but with reflection. What can we learn? What's new and different here? Entrepreneurship is often an expression of individualism, and there may not be generally projectable findings in every case, but there's always learning. I'm going to introduce you today to an extraordinary entrepreneur, someone with a lot of experience and wisdom to share. He started his own professional services firm in the field of executive recruiting with $2,500 in borrowed money and 6 months of experience with the market-leading large corporate firm. He built his startup into a partnership with the highest possible level of prestige in his industry, handling the most important assignments, recruiting CEOs and other C-suite positions for the largest global corporations. He was also instrumental in staffing some of the highest growth tech companies by finding the right executive experience in old-style corporates and transferring those executives to the new industries and firms. A very tricky challenge of culture and chemistry and performance to get right. Not only did our guest entrepreneur succeed in that field, he also started from the ground up firms in the California wine industry and in athletic clothing, apparel, and equipment, and sold them onwards to larger acquirers. Not only that, he launched a very successful venture capital fund, financing seed stage companies, i.e. at that tricky stage where the idea has some initial marketplace traction, but there's no proven business model, no developed structure, and tremendous pressure to grow using venture capital funding. He gets to examine many, many business plans and pitch decks, and, much more importantly, meet entrepreneurs one-on-one and look them in the eye to make a critical assessment of their potential. And if all that were not enough, our guest is an endurance athlete who has won races and set world records in long-distance ocean swimming, endurance running, desert trail running, and ultra-marathoning. He's still doing it today. This extraordinary entrepreneur is Vito Biala. He never went to business school or to college. His education in thinking on one's feet, as he puts it, was in the war in Vietnam. It set him up for all the achievements in his life after the military. Such a man has many insights and slices of wisdom to share. Let's listen as, in an act of methodological individualism, we drill down into Vito's take on the core essence of what makes a successful
Vito, hello.
Hello, Hunter.
Thank you for joining us on Economics for Entrepreneurs.
Well, thanks for inviting me. I'm honored.
Well, Vito, you've been in the business that we call executive recruiting, which is matching people and their personalities and their skills and their curriculum vitae to jobs and requirements for decades, if I can say that. You started it as an entrepreneurial venture from scratch. You grew it into a nationally and globally renowned business. And we want to talk about that. We're also going to talk about you as a venture capitalist, identifying entrepreneurs that you think can run and grow a startup, which is another kind of matching people to jobs. So we'll cover both of those in order, and I'm hoping to get insights from you, Vito, about the fit between personality, temperament, skills, qualifications, chemistry, and jobs and entrepreneurship. So that's where we're going to go.
Sounds great. Honored to be here.
So let's start with how you got started in the executive recruitment business. Tell us your origin story.
No, God. I joined the military when I was 17, on my 17th birthday, and they promised to send me to Europe, and instead they sent me to Vietnam, and that was a very interesting experience. It was 1968, and if you ever see the movie Platoon, that was my unit, Tropic Lightning. So when I got out, I was 20 years old, and I was looking for a job, and an employment agency hired me, and they said, you would be a great recruiter. Headhunter. I said, what is that? Like, what do you do? He said, well, you know, you send people out on job interviews and then they get hired and then you make some money. It's like, okay, great. So let's do that. So they hired me and they fired me 2 days later. I thought, what did I do wrong? So I went downtown Chicago. I looked in the phone book and I found the biggest executive search firm and I applied for a job and I said, you know, I can do this. And they put me through 21 interviews. They said, go down to the state, lie about your age because you're underage. You have to be 21. And I did, and they hired me, and I made, you know, $42,000 in my first year. So that was the start of my career. So in Chicago, 332 South Michigan Avenue. So that's how I got started. And 6 months later, I left and moved to San Francisco and started my own firm, that's Bialon Associates. So
that's brilliant. So what was the nature of the recruitment business back then? Was it young and developing? Was it, they didn't have the big firms that we have today, or it did? What was it like back then?
Well, it was the early stages. There was a guy named Lester Korn, and he partnered with a guy named Ferry. I forget his first name, but that became Korn Ferry. And they started charging money up front, saying, we'll find you an executive or whoever you need. And that became the retainer business. Back in those days, it was all contingency. So, you know, we barely had faxes and photocopiers. And I remember, you know, sending out resumes, stapled my business card and mailing it to somebody and calling 3 days later saying, did you get the resume from, you know, Harry or Sally or whoever? And they said, yes, we did. And we'd like to interview him or her. And it was like, okay, great. So let's set up an appointment. And it was all, you know, dialing the phone with, you know, your finger going around clockwise. So it was much, much different than it is today. Today, everything happens at lightning speed. So,
what made you think you could start your own recruiting company after you'd been in the industry just a few months?
I think being naive, being, I'd say fearless because I just came out of war. I didn't know any better. And I said, I can do this. And I don't need a boss to tell me how many phone calls I have to make. And I decided to start my own business. So I met a friend who was working for Clairol. He became president of Clairol, Bristol Myers, and he hired somebody from me. And he says, you're really good at what you're doing. And I said, okay, great. So I asked him to loan me some money, and I said, I'm raising $10,000, and I'm $2,500 short. I lied. I didn't have $7,500, but he said, okay, great. I'll loan you $2,500. And that's how I got started. So, and I made quite a bit of money my first year as an independent. And I think the naivety is the point I'm trying to make is that if you're a structured individual and you go to school and you go to college and you go to universities, you become programmed to think a certain way. I never had that privilege or liability, I would say, because I had to think outside the box. When you're in the jungle and you're fighting a war and you're doing things that, you know, you were never taught in business school, you become a completely different person, I think. And that's what happened to me, basically. So I got into executive search and I said, okay, great. I have to think on my feet. I have to think for myself. And it started by, I would call Ernest Gallo on the phone, and he'd answer the phone and say, "Hey, nice to hear from you. Nobody ever calls me because everybody's intimidated." And it was like, okay. So I called the chairman of General Motors. I called the chairman of B.F. Goodrich. It's like, you know, and these people were so nice and polite. And I said, okay, what I want you to do is call my head of HR and tell him I told you to call. And next thing I know, I'm getting a search from a big company. It's like, wow, you know. And I was too young to go out and meet them in person because I was a baby face, but I had a deep voice. And so I just kind of bullshitted my way through life, and it worked. And, you know, I think naivety is an asset. So universities can program you to think a certain way, and I think that can be a liability. So that's how I got started.
Well, that's a brilliant story. And you acquired clients by calling them, calling as high up on the totem pole as you possibly could. How did you then, you did a good job, obviously, of matching the right people to the jobs that they had. What was the skill set that you developed there? How did you become great at finding the right people for them?
I'll give you the secret to executive search. If you develop relationships with people that you're compatible with, and then you identify smart people, and smart people tend to hang around other smart people. They don't tend to hang around, you know, less smart people. So, you know, there's superstars, and then there's people who aren't superstars. Not everybody's a superstar. So I got to be sensitive to how I describe people. Okay. There's absolute rocket science executives that are just fantastic. And if you tap into that, then you realize that you're swimming with the right fish or the right crowd. I'd have to say Procter & Gamble is probably the best company on the planet. They have more CEOs, something like 52% that are running the globe, whether it's, you know, Microsoft or who knows, whatever. But I tapped in early into the P&G system and the peers there. And all you have to do is ask somebody who's the fastest rising star at Procter & Gamble in the you know, whatever division that they, health and beauty is, or and you get to know those people, and then they respect you, and then you start building relationships. And so suddenly you're the vendor of super talent that you start bringing into other companies. I mean, I put Procter & Gamble people into Citicorp. I put them into Quaker Oats. I put them into Clorox. The list is endless. So that's how I established myself. So, you know, building relationships, finding out who the smart people are, finding where the best companies are that breed the best talent, and Procter & Gamble is on top of my list.
So you could characterize that as looking for people who perform well. They perform well in a great organization like a Procter & Gamble. What about personal traits, about intangibles, personal chemistry, and those kinds of things? Do they count?
Oh, absolutely. You know, the Procter & Gamble has a philosophy, as I think you might know, that they tend to promote people faster than they should be accustomed to or comfortable with. And they start to weed out, 25% of the people that, you know, get promoted that fail, they kind of get weeded out, and the rest rise to the top. So it's, you know, personal traits, they're very important. You got to be ambitious. You got to be enthusiastic. You got to be aggressive. You know, and you have to, you know, bump your head into the wall a couple of times, and sometimes, you know, you get fired, which is a good thing, not from Procter & Gamble, but as you work your way up the ladder, I think it's very important to keep pushing forward. So that's a common trait. Yeah, absolutely.
Did you ever use any kind of psychological assessment test, like the Myers-Briggs or the Big Five or anything like that, or you depend more on those performance measures?
No, I think we looked at performance measures. We looked at the psychological testing. There's a company called Personalysis, which is pretty good. And a client says, you know, I want you to test people using that methodology. And I said, okay, fine. I said, why don't you test me? and they tested me, and it was very revealing. And it was like, wow, okay, that he pretty well nailed me in 15 minutes. It's like, you know, aggressive, assertive, you know, creative, all that other kind of stuff. And so when we tested candidates, it was pretty accurate. But at the end of the day, it doesn't really mean that much. They were trying to use it more for compatibility with the existing organization. So, but in terms of evaluating a CEO or executive talent, we never really used that. You know, people said, well, you know, my chairman of the board wants me to use a psychiatrist. It's like, okay, good. You know, did that for 2 hours, but it didn't really conclude anything. So I'm not a big fan of that.
Vito and I are talking about his view of the attributes of successful executives and successful entrepreneurs. For entrepreneurs specifically, you should self-assess. You should be able to answer the question, who am I? We've developed our own exclusive entrepreneurial self-assessment, and it's not intended to give you a personality test. It's intended to make you think. We've got questions about self-reliance, about self-augmentation, making yourself bigger and better, and about your skills in facilitating customer value. It's short and simple, and as I said, just to make you think. You can find it at e4epod.com/self. That's e4epod.com/self. Nobody will see it but you, but we hope it will be useful. And now back to our conversation.
One of the things you've mentioned that's really interesting is moving people out of environments where they know the game and perform well to more uncertain environments. I know that you've moved people from a Procter & Gamble or another kind of hierarchical big business in consumer packaged goods, perhaps into a high-growth Silicon Valley firm that doesn't have that kind of structure and culture. They're much more agile. What have you learned about people who make that transition well? Can you identify those kinds of folks?
It's very hard to make that transition because people are they go to college, they get an undergrad, they get an MBA in marketing, and their structure and their thinking. And so what they do is they rely on that, and that's their toolbox, okay? So they're structured in how they think and how they approach problems. You don't go to school like I did, you're forced to think in a different way. And so the best thing that can happen to a Procter & Gamble or a Xerox or an IBM person or a person that comes out of that environment to go into a fast-moving, highly entrepreneurial environment is to stub their toe, get fired, get thrown out, have to regroup and say, wow, okay, this isn't the way the world works. And so when they get into a Google or a fast-moving, you know, Adobe or Airbnb, where, you know, that basic those basic principles don't apply, then you're forced to think rather quickly. Otherwise, you don't survive. So it's hard for somebody to be, you know, 20 years at Clorox or Procter & Gamble and make that transition. So I've seen it over and over again, where they tend to fail on their first venture. The second or third one, yeah, they learn to adapt and they sort of go back to the grassroots of their instinct versus the textbook.
Fascinating. Well, let's just stay with big companies for one more question, Vito. You
sure.
About CEOs, and let's say you've got 10 candidates that did well at Procter & Gamble or did well at some other giant corporation. You're going to move them to another giant corporation as a CEO. It's their first time CEO. Can you identify the one that will be a better CEO than the other nine? Are there any characteristics that you've found out over time?
Interesting question. I think what you have to do is when you look at placing a CEO anywhere, you have to look at the compatibility. So if you were to try to place a Procter & Gamble person in a company that's run by Unilever or Colgate-Palmolive, that would be a complete disaster, okay? Because they don't like each other and they don't speak the same language. So you have to kind of look at the compatibility. So if it's a Colgate Palmolive company, or if it's an Alberto Culver company, or whatever in consumer products, you have to respect the culture that they came from. So say you got a company that's being run by a bunch of Procter & Gamble people. It's like, you know, the easiest thing to do is to place another Procter & Gamble person there. They like each other. They have camaraderie. It's instant chemistry, and they think alike. And, you know, that person is going to be embraced by that community. So try to bring another culture into a company, that's failure. So that's one thing we look at. And in terms of leadership, finding a good CEO, it always comes down to leadership. Leadership, leadership, leadership. That's the person that has to, you know, be able to, you know, the old saying, grab the bull by the horns. But, you know, forget the bull. Just, you know, embrace the people, you know, be compatible, be respectful. And, you know, make the transition to becoming a successful CEO. You have to have empathy for people, and they recognize that instantly.
Well, good. So that's a perfect word to transition on, Vito, empathy, because we say that's also the key skill of entrepreneurs. And you know a lot about entrepreneurs because you founded a venture capital fund. And you probably see hundreds and thousands of business ideas and pitch decks and revenue models. But I know that you look at entrepreneurs as people and as personalities and a set of lived experiences and so on. Do you have an evaluative model for who's going to be a good startup entrepreneur?
Well, that's a tough one, Hunter. I think I heard Warren Buffett talk the other day about something. They said, what's the key to your success? He says, I'm not smart. I've been lucky.
Mm-hmm.
So
consistently.
I think there's a lot to be said for that. So I think the most important thing for an entrepreneur or a founder or a start a business is that the ability to change gears quickly. In Silicon Valley, they call it pivot. Change your business plan, you know, change your business model, so forth. I like to say, let's, you know, hi, Mr. Entrepreneur, nice of you to be here and, you know, ask us for money. Why don't we put your business plan aside for a minute? Let's have a heart-to-heart conversation. You know, how do you handle a bar fight? You know, somebody insults your girlfriend or your wife, you know, there's three guys standing behind you. What do you do? And they go, oh, I mean, you have to think on your feet. And if you can't make payroll and you're broke and you got a week left to survive in your business, what are you going to do? How are you going to handle that? So those are the kinds of questions that I like to ask. And you kind of get to the core of the individual. You can't call 911 and you can't say, well, I'll go back to business school and ask for advice. It's like, you know, it's too late for that. So you've got to be very resourceful. You got to be extremely creative. And You kind of have to sort people out how fast they think. And so that's, to me, that's the key. So that's what makes a successful entrepreneur.
What's the right answer to the bar fight question? If you ask, I'd freeze probably. What's the right answer?
What's the right answer to that? I can only talk from personal experience. I was 13 years old. I was on a motorcycle and I was surrounded by 15 hoodlums in a neighborhood, and they were going to beat the crap out of me. And I said, you guys are nothing but a bunch of punks. And I had to think really fast. And I said, okay, let me go get my guys. I'll bring 15 of my guys back here, and I'll be back here in 20 minutes. And they bought the story. And they said, okay, take off. We'll see you in 20 minutes. And I said, I'm going to kick the crap out of you. And I never left so fast on my motorcycle. It was like unbelievable. So, you know, I mean, they don't teach you that in business school, okay? It's just you gotta think on your feet, and business is the same way. It's there's so many minefields and so many, you know, issues that come up that you have to deal with. That, you know, there's no manual for that. It's just you gotta be creative, and the more creative you get, the more resourceful you get, the more agile you become, and the more productive you become. So, I remember one phone call I made. Going back to talking to leaders, I called the chairman of FedEx and I said, well, you know, I figured out that, you know, he's working late. So I waited until 11:45 at night, his time back in New York. And it was a guy named Tom Oliver. And I called him. I said, you know, I'm a headhunter. I'd like to talk to you about doing executive search work. And he says, Vito, I'm just sitting here. I'm stunned. I said, what happened? He said, 5 minutes ago, I got a phone call from my venture capital firm that they're funding. Federal Express is going to survive. And we had until midnight to pull this off. So, I mean,
wow.
You don't learn that. You don't learn that at Harvard. It's just, those are just resourceful instances. And the guy gave me a search and he hired me and it was like just wonderful. And, you know, we did the high 5-0 with the phone and I was only 20 years old. Okay. So it was just, those are things that leave an impression on you for the rest of your life.
Absolutely. You know, I've heard that story before too, not from you, but from other people. If you want to reach somebody on the phone who's high up, call them way after office hours because, as you say,
yes.
A, they're going to be working late, and B, they're going to answer on their own phone because the secretary's gone home. Does that still work?
Absolutely.
Wow.
I mean, in the old days, nowadays you use email and whatever, but it's having the courage to fail. And when I called Ernest Gallo, okay, I said, hi, Mr. Gallo. I said, you just paid me $10,000 last year. I want you to put me on retainer because I'm bringing all your best people to you. And he said, oh, he interviewed me for an hour and then he offered me a job. You know, and I called him back the next day and I said, you know, I'm so flattered. And you know, you've got your name on the bottle. I've got my name on the door and I've got to respectfully decline, but I admire you a great deal. And, you know, I continue to do executive search work for him. But that phone call, you know, what have you got to lose? Mm-hmm. You know, you can't fear rejection. Rejection is a positive. It's not a negative.
Yeah. So that's a trait that often comes up is courage. So could we count that as something that entrepreneurs need?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
You know, fear of failure is not healthy. Just go out and do it. What have you got to lose? Somebody says no. Okay, fine. You go on to the next person. Go on to the next client. You've got to create your own destiny. So you're a captain of your own ship. You're inside your body, and it's like, what are you afraid of? Just go do it.
Yeah, the fancy term for that in psychological assessment is a bias for action. So you just said that, I think, is just go do it.
Absolutely. Just get on with it.
Yeah. And that, so another word they use in these kinds of assessments, Vito, is a special relationship with risk. You embrace it. Hey, it's dangerous out there, so I'm okay with that. But you also try to narrow it. You try to get to the point of success by eliminating the risk, by riding your motorcycle away from the 15 hoodlums. I like that story.
Yeah. No, it's a true story. I'll never forget that one.
You look back on your portfolio of companies and in the venture capital fund, and like any VC fund, there are ones that succeeded and ones that failed. Can you look back and say, boy, the personality of the CEO had something to do with that, the success or the failure? Does it come down to that personality? He didn't have enough courage, or she did have enough courage? Can you see that looking backwards?
I think I understand the question. I think people have to have courage. I think at times that somebody needs a little bit of support or a nudge to push them in the right direction. And I think older people, when I say older, I'm talking about you and me, because we're not teenagers. We're not teenagers anymore. You know, John Sebastiani, if I can name him by name, is an incredible individual. He was raised in the family business, in the wine business. And he called me one day and he said, look, I'm thinking about starting a business and I'm thinking about starting, you know, those people are snacking more than they are having, you know, long lunches with martinis and whatever. It's, you know, there's a grazing culture going on and I'm thinking about starting a snack business. And I said, okay, so what's holding you up? He says, I'm not sure if it's going to be successful. I'm not sure if I should do it. And I I was pretty harsh with him. And I said, John, I said, you're 34 years old or 35, I think. I said, get off your ass and do it. I said, what have you got to lose? And we had a 15-minute phone call, and he hung up and he said, okay, I'm doing it. Like, okay. And he started Crave Jerky, and he sold it for 4 years later for $240 million. So, and you can talk to him, and he likes to repeat the story that he just needed somebody that believed in him, mm-hmm. kind of push him over the edge. And that's what happened. So I don't know how else to explain that, but that's, you know, is it courage? I think it's nice to have a little bit of a support group. It's nice to have somebody around you that believes in you and has faith in you. And I think that's very, very helpful. So encouraging entrepreneurs, I think that goes a long ways.
So we tend to say here that everybody should be an entrepreneur because it creates such a vibrant economy. It's about helping other people. It's about designing great new products and services. There's everything positive, but perhaps there are some kinds of people that should take a different route than entrepreneurship. Would you say that?
Yes, absolutely. I think to be an entrepreneur is inherent. I think it's something that's just exists. I don't know how to explain it. You know, Michael Dell is a friend of ours. I met him through because his wife Susan was interested in buying Zoot Sports, and we had discussions, and that's how we met. And they invited us to dinner, and they had a big party over there. And I talked to his father, and he said, "I said, tell me about Michael." He said, "Michael's unique." He said, "Michael used to go inside his room and take apart vacuum cleaners and toasters with a screwdriver when he was 8 years old, and all he did was fiddle and take things apart." It's like, you know, that's not something you learn in school. So that's how basically he started Dell Computers. He started putting parts together and pieces together, and he created, you know, Dell Computers. And so, you know, some people naturally evolve that way. Other people, you know, they don't need to be entrepreneurs. That's okay. Let somebody else take the risk. Let somebody else be the entrepreneur. You know, it's okay to work for Google as employee number 150 or AOL as employee number 200. You can make millions and billions of dollars. You don't need to be the entrepreneur. So that's okay. You'll feel it inside if you're really cut out to do that or not. So I don't know how else to describe it. Not everybody is suited to be an entrepreneur.
Well, I like that term. You'll feel it inside. There's a theory about entrepreneurship called effectual entrepreneurship. Yep. And they say the first question is, who am I? Do you have a good self-assessment of yourself? Do you have a good feel for who you are? And that's a good first step. So, but that's instinctive. Absolutely. You've got to know yourself.
Absolutely. Totally agree.
Okay. Well, you've been a good entrepreneur yourself, not only starting the Aller and Associates, but also Zoot and a number of other things. So you must have that good feel for yourself. Is that confidence? Is it courage? What's the Vito feel about Vito?
Oh, I think it's having fun in life, enjoying life, taking risks. Taking risks is rewarding. Giving of yourself is very rewarding. Helping other people is rewarding. You know, we started Zoot Sports because we decided, you know, let's see what we can do with it. It's fun to create stuff. It's fun to have some courage. And whether it's athletics or sports or business, it's just fun to do stuff. It's just get on with it, you know. And the only thing I can say for entrepreneurs is that if you're ever going to start a business, you know, do it at the highest level. If you're going to, you know, I built a winery with my wife. We had it for 10 years. We sold it to Chinese investors. We made the best possible brand we could, the best possible product we could. We had the best winemaker. We had the best vineyard manager. We sold wine for $150 a bottle. And it was great. And always aim for the high goal of any product that you make, whether it's wetsuits or shoes or wine, because you can always go down in price, but you can never go up in price. So, you know, don't come out with a $20 bottle of wine and expect to sell it for $200 because it's never going to work. So that's all I can say on that topic.
Yeah, that's great advice. Thank you. Hey, one last question in this space, though. You've been a bit disparaging about the business school experience, and a lot of business schools now have schools of entrepreneurship or incubators and those kinds of things. So our question is, can entrepreneurship be taught? That's the first question. Or trained, perhaps, like, you know, people like you can train others, or mentored. And the John Sebastiani story you talked about, I would put you in the role of mentor there. So out of teaching, training, or mentoring, which is most useful for entrepreneurs?
Wow, that's a complicated question. I think mentoring works. I think what you have to do is you have to empower people to believe in themselves when sometimes they have a narrow margin of self-confidence. And I'll just give you one small example. I'm mentoring a 15-year-old girl. She wanted to be a long-distance swimmer. And I said, let's do a relay. So we swam 12 miles in the middle of the night from Anacapa to Oxnard. This year, she completed her first solo swim in 7 hours, which was phenomenal. She raised $8,000 for charity. And all she needed was a swim buddy, a person who has a little bit of credibility in the athletic community, which I think I do. And, you know, we're current world record holders in, you know, long distance swimming around the world. And so when she and I became sort of swim buddies, we swim on every Saturday and Sunday, and she gained a certain amount of confidence. And so it just, she just blossomed like unbelievable. Now she's on her way to become one of the greatest swimmers in athletic, you know, events and in the swimming community. So, and I introduced her to other people who are some of the best swimmers in the world, and she's off and running. So, you know, she's fortunate to have access to that, but yes, it can be taught. And I think if the desire is there, you can help people along and just sort of, you know, give what you have to give. And it's so wonderful to see that develop. And she's on her way, you know. It's like riding a bicycle. She doesn't need training wheels anymore. She's going to be a great, great swimmer. She already is.
Well, you used a great phrase there, Vito, a narrow margin or a narrow band of self-confidence. You can help people widen that band. That's a nice thought. You've also just revealed something I was going to tell our listeners, that you're a very accomplished athlete. You hold world records in punishing sports like marathon distance swimming that you mentioned, but also mountain and trail running and desert running. Tell us a little bit about that, and what's the Ironman personality? What does it take to do that?
Oh, there's multiple events that I've done, and it just sort of came out of desire to impress my wife, because I met her and she said, I'm a runner. I said, oh yeah, so am I. So I lied. I wasn't a runner. But we went for a run we ran for 13 minutes down to the yacht club. I had a beer and a cigar, and she said, well, let's go run. I said, we just did. She said, no, we didn't. So I had to up my game. It's like, okay, great. So I went out and did 8 marathons my first year. And then, you know, she did her marathons, and then we did Western States. And then I tried to impress her more, and I did, you know, Badwater, which is a 135-mile race through the desert in July, which is, the temperature is 125 degrees. And I just kind of got on this bandwagon to try to push myself to certain limits to see how far you can go. And then, you know, the ultimate, excuse me, the ultimate race was probably doing an Ultraman in Hawaii, which goes around the island. And it was a 63-hour race. So racing 6 days and doing a double back-to-back Ultraman has never been done before. So it was kind of like, okay, that's fun. And then we started the 501c3 because we were raising money. I raised money for, doing bad water, and then we started night train swimmers. We swam the English Channel as a relay, and we swam from Sacramento to San Francisco, 100-mile swim, and we kept raising money more and more for charity. We raised $250,000 for the Navy SEAL Foundation. We raised the same amount for Semper Fi, which is the Marines, and a guy named Parsons heard about it, and he got on stage. His CFO got on stage and gave us a check for $1 million. And so we just kept raising money for charity, which is phenomenal. So we raised money for Semper Fi, Navy SEAL Foundations, and Wounded Warrior. And, you know, I guess the story here is that if you don't do something, you got to do something to get things in motion. We would have never gotten a check for $1 million from John Parsons, the founder of GoDaddy, if we hadn't, you know, held this event and done this race and started this charity. It's kind of like starting a movement, I guess, is what it boils down to. So it's just, you know, make stuff happen, get on with it, just do it. It's, you know, it sounds like a Nike commercial, but it's just, yeah, get on with it, do it. Don't be afraid.
Well, it's a great message, Vito. Thank you. Thank you very much. And you know, just to wrap up and conclude, we try to communicate the message that entrepreneurship is good for society. It's capitalism in its best form. And people today, young people, are very negative about capitalism. They say it's exploitative and you shouldn't make a profit and all of those kinds of things. But everything that you've described today about entrepreneurship, the achievement that you have attained, the service that you've given to companies by hiring great people for them, the mentoring you've done, the money you've raised in charity, the records you've set, those are all entrepreneurial contributions to society. So I would like to hear your point of view about entrepreneurs' contributions to society and how we can do a good job of communicating that.
Oh, wow. Well, entrepreneurs make the world turn, you know? And all I can say is, if we're closing this discussion, it's like, don't be afraid, don't be fearful. You know, as what Winston Churchill said, the only thing we have to fear is fear itself. Don't be afraid.
Well, good. Well, Vito, you've been brilliant today. Thank you for communicating all those things to our listeners. I think you'll be very inspirational to anybody who hears your message. Don't be afraid and do it. So thank you very much.
I'm flattered. Thank you for inviting me, Hunter.
You're welcome. Bye for now.
Economics for Entrepreneurs is a production of the Mises Institute. To explore more content like this, visit Mises.org. That's Mises.org. For more from Hunter Hastings, check out HunterHastings.com.